Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Maybe for starters, you could just introduce yourself with your name and the name of this place.
My name is David Marsh. I'm a third-generation store owner of Marsh's Free Museum.
And how would you describe Marsh's Free Museum to someone who's never been here?
A fun gift shop. We are a museum. We have shipwreck memorabilia. We have freaks of nature, oddities, animals.
There's all kinds of pretty exotic taxidermy on the wall, including one I noticed in the last room that was the head of a werewolf. You've got a collection of old-timey washboards on the ceiling here.
Yeah,
you've got some...
And up here...
Wind chimes, of course.
Well, up here we have actually, it's a human tapeworm that was taken from a human body.
An actual tapeworm?
Yeah, it's in the bottle up there on the wall.
Sure. And it's a kind of a, you'd say a roadside attraction kind of a feel?
Oh yeah, most certainly it's a roadside attraction. Just a collection that my grandpa started back in the 20s. He was a little bit of an eccentric. He had joined the circus when he was 17 years old and decided that he needed to open a gift shop. He picked up our Seberg H Orchestra, which is one of only two on the West Coast, and it's a very valuable orchestration machine. It was built in the 1920s.
Not sure what song it's on.
So, I mean, my grandpa was, he was a showman. He had a lot of flair, you know.
Is he the one who procured the most famous resident of Marsh's Free Museum?
You mean Jake?
Yes.
Yeah.
And maybe you could tell us Jake's full name?
Yeah. Well, Jake the Alligator Man. And actually, that was my mom's decision to purchase Jake.
Is he here somewhere that we can
see?
Yeah,
he is. He's over here.
Oh, man. Jake the Alligator. Yeah, I'm really excited to meet him.
This here on the wall are several newspaper articles that came out about Jake. And probably the most famous one was when Jake made the front cover of the World Weekly News, November 9th, 1993.
Could you read that headline for me?
And it says, half alligator, half man found in Florida swamp. He has been on their cover, I think, two or three times after that, where he escaped and got loose in New York and killed a couple of people in New York, and then he had babies and... Goes to show you, you can't believe everything you read, but, you know, here he is in person. So.
Wow. So he looks like a pretty small, what is he, about 3 feet long, 3.5 feet
long?
Yeah,
he's about 4 foot.
Uh-huh. And he looks like the sort of mummified remains of a human being in the front, kind of segueing into, I guess, the mummified remains of an alligator in the back.
Right. This is a story about an alligator man. He goes by the name of Jake. Some say he's fake, but that's not true. He's the biggest badass gator in the bayou and a damn good friend of mine. His mama was a gator. Daddy was a man.
Can I ask why you have chosen to carry on the family business?
I wasn't cut out to be a rocket scientist. And I wasn't cut out to be a brain surgeon. So my dad showed me the ropes a little bit. And well, it's different. It's fun. As a family business, this is a lot of hard work, a lot of stress sometimes too.
Yeah, well, family businesses can be complicated, but they can also be really, really rich and provide an awful lot of satisfaction, both for the people who run it and the people who patronize it. And that is the theme for our show today on Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I've been here talking with David Marsh from Marsh's Free Museum in Long Beach, Washington. Thank you so much for showing me around and introducing me to Jake the Alligator.
Oh, yes, Jake the Alligator Man, and he thanks you, and it's my pleasure to have you.
And we're going to have stories of family businesses from all over the region coming up right here on the show, so don't go away.
So this story is less about a literal family business and more about how we negotiate this whole business of family, especially when a family member believes that she's in the wrong role. In this case, that family member is Sophie, a curly-haired, twinkle-eyed 6-year-old who loves her pet rat.
That's Purple, the blacky one, the black one.
How come you named him Purple?
Because I love Purple.
She loves Purple. She also loves her chickens and her dog. But if she could have any pet in the whole world...
I'm stuck between a rat or a dog.
Well, you're lucky because you've got both of those.
Oh, can I choose two?
Yes.
Rat and the dog.
Sophie was born a boy. Now, we've all seen big changes in how society looks at transgender people in the last few years. And now science is starting to see them differently, too. To understand how, a little history on Sophie and her family, who live in Bellingham. Her mom, Jenna Lopez, says she started seeing signs that her son wasn't going to be a regular boy back before he turned 2. She figured it would let up, but it didn't.
She started correcting us on pronouns, and, you know, she'd say things like, I'm a she, not a he. She would cry if we misgendered her. She'd become angry. And at one point, she would not allow us to call her by her birth name. So when that became that persistent, I knew it was more than just experimentation.
So as a parent, now you have this dilemma. Do you go with it? Or do you assume that this will pass? I mean, my son spent a year insisting he was a werewolf. Now he does not. So do you risk reinforcing a temporary phase, or worse, nudging her toward a life of challenges that non-trans people don't have? And then there's just the fact of having to let go of that little boy that you thought you had.
Her birth name, you know, was tied to my family in a way, tied to her grandfather. And there's that loss. There's just things you just don't really think about.
But you grieve that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I used to be Yoshi. I didn't like being called Yoshi, and they used to think I was a boy.
How did you tell them that that wasn't who you are?
Because I proved it, right?
Proved it?
Yeah.
Sophie did prove it to Jenna, at least as far as Jenna's concerned. It took time, and it took Sophie's dad, Vernon, having his own journey with it. He shuddered to think of his child being bullied, or worse.
So he was like, well, maybe we need to do something to, you know, kind of toughen her up or make her more, you know, more male.
And also, they knew the stats, which seem grim, though more on that in a minute. Research has shown that transgender kids have very high rates of depression and anxiety, and the major study found that 41% of transgender people attempt suicide before age 20. That's 9 times higher than the rest of the population. So all that played into Sophie's dad's thinking.
You know, he loves his child and wants her to be as healthy as possible and live a, you know, healthy, normal life. And so he, realizing that if he supported her, that was more likely to happen, I think. You know, he was maybe 4 to 6 months behind, I would say. It took him to come around. I mean, he did a great job and he's very supportive now.
Vernon and Jenna decided to support Sophie, to let her grow her hair out and call her she, and just allow her to be their daughter. So what might life be like for a kid like Sophie? Is she in for a lifetime of struggles with mental health? That is the question Christina Olson was wondering about when a different child, the 10-year-old child of a friend, was transitioning. Olson is a psychology professor at the University of Washington, and so she looked up the research.
There were no studies to date about kids who had actually fully socially transitioned. So I had no idea, based on the literature, what impact my friend's decision would have on her child's life.
Socially transitioned means children whose families let them live in the gender that they feel that they are. We're not talking about kids taking hormones or getting surgery or anything. So there are studies of the mental health of trans kids, and they look bleak. But Olson says that those studies are based on kids in clinical settings where they've often been brought in to be treated or cured. And that raises this question: how much of the depression and anxiety come from being transgender, and how much of it comes from the way that transgender people are treated? What about kids whose families support them? To answer that key question, Olson is doing what she says is the first large longitudinal study of those kids. It's early, but she just published results comparing 73 trans kids aged 3 to 12 to two control groups.
They have exactly the national average for depression, so they're no more or less depressed. They show a marginal, like a tiny bit of an increase in anxiety, but nowhere near the rates that previous work has found.
The study can't make a direct connection between the healthier outcomes and parental support. But Olson says at least it shows the struggles aren't inevitable.
These are certainly the first results to ever show that you could have a large group of gender nonconforming kids who are doing well.
But there's still that question. What if this is a passing thing? Olson is studying kids as young as age 3. Can they really know?
In terms of it being a phase, this is something that worries a lot of people, and the scientific literature is actively debating. So our study is only about 3 years in, but we have yet to have any of the kids switch back.
He's like the boy in the witches, Mommy.
Sophie's mother, Jenna Lopez, is pretty sure that she can tell the difference between a phase and true gender identity. Take, for example, her older daughter, 9-year-old Nora.
You know, she thinks right now like that being trans is really cool, and she wishes she could be trans, and she's tried that on a few times, you know.
Tried on a male identity?
Right. You know, she says, I'm a boy, and then she went to being, well, I'm not a boy or a girl, and I think now, actually this year, she started admitting that she likes princesses.
That, Jenna figures, is probably a phase. But Sophie's experience is different. Sophie's feelings run deep.
She had a tremendous amount of dysphoria around her penis. She didn't want to touch herself, which, you know, I just tried to help her love her body. It's part of her body. Even if she doesn't want to keep it, she has to take care of it. And now she is able to touch and care for herself. She's actually even proud that she can pee standing up.
Now that Sophie is Sophie, and the whole family's on board, Jenna says Sophie is much happier.
She blossomed much more. She was much more expressive, and she kind of bubbles sometimes. She just sits there and she's jumping around, and that wasn't really there before.
I like being a kid.
You like being a kid?
Yeah.
What do you like about being a kid?
That I get to be Sophie.
You like being you?
Yeah.
You can learn more about Christina Olson's research on the well-being of transgender kids at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about the family business. Julie Randolph Habaker grew up in a little farming town in Ohio called Fremont. It was the kind of place where the state fair was a big deal. Her father was a pathologist, and if you're not sure what that is, it's a doctor who looks at tissue samples and biopsies and things in a lab to help make diagnoses. And it being a rural area, that often meant driving around to several different local hospitals and occasionally bringing his work home with him.
Often at the end of a long day, he wouldn't necessarily want to go all the way to the central hospital and take the samples into the lab. So he would put them in a brown paper bag in a refrigerator. Well, I didn't think anything about it. And I'm on my way to school. I was probably in third or fourth grade at the time. And I grabbed my lunch bag and I went to school. And around lunchtime, I opened my bag and I realized that I had someone's gallbladder in a jar in my lunch bag. And so I had to call my dad and say, yeah, I think you have my peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you know.
Was he the kind of guy who would have thought that was funny?
Oh, he thought it was hysterical.
Julie remembers her dad as warm and open and, frankly, kind of a giant dork. For example,
one of the fondest memories I have is he took us all to the Galapagos Islands. He was a huge fan of Darwin. We all received our own leather-bound edition of The Origin of Species. We all got t-shirts with a picture of Charles Darwin on the front and our names embroidered in the corner. So we had a boat and went around to all the islands. And
you must have been looking pretty slick with your own personally monogrammed Darwin shirt.
Exactly. By then, though, we were used to the geek culture in our household.
Julie eventually followed in her father's footsteps to become a pathologist herself. She's on the research end, not on the diagnosing end. She works at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center here in Seattle. Early on in her career, her dad would actively nose around in her studies. He'd sit in on classes, and Julie jokes he was one of the three human beings to ever actually read her dissertation. And while she was finishing up her PhD at Ohio State, her dad got sick.
My dad had been volunteering at the School of Medicine at Ohio State, and he would come in a couple times a month and work with medical students. And he had actually just been teaching a course on the clinical signs and symptoms of pneumonia. Went home, the next morning woke up and had typical symptoms. He had pain in his chest when he was breathing and said, I have pneumonia. And drove himself, of course, to his doctor.
So he diagnosed himself, drove himself there.
Right. Wouldn't want to say anything to my mom. He came back and he said, I have some antibiotics. I've got a little touch of pneumonia. It happens in people, right? And he had a pretty nasty case of pneumonia, but we weren't sure what was causing it. So it took several weeks to clear up the pneumonia enough for imaging to reveal that he had a very large lung tumor. So he deteriorated fairly quickly.
How old was he?
He was 64. Not very old. I arranged for him to be transferred to Ohio State Hospital, which is where I was doing my research and where I was working, which was good because I knew everyone there. So I could kind of come and go as I pleased, but I also knew his pulmonologist. I knew eventually his oncologist, his surgeon.
Did you know at that time that it was a likely terminal diagnosis?
When he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, I don't think it really sunk in until he'd had some biopsies done. And being a pathologist, he wanted to know what it looked like under the microscope. And he was too sick at the time to go down to the lab to look at the slides. So he asked me if I would go. And so I met one of my professors at the time, Wendy Frankel. And we sat down at a teaching microscope so she could look through her side of the microscope and I could see exactly what she was looking at. And she showed me the slides of my dad's cancer. And I think it was probably pretty awkward for her to have someone just weeping on the other side of the microscope as she was describing this tumor to me. But once I saw the cells, he had what we call a poorly differentiated lung carcinoma. As far as tumor cells go, these are big and ugly and nasty looking. So it's pretty clear that this was an advanced case and that he probably wasn't going to survive his disease.
Did it look sinister?
It did, because the whole field was just full of cancer cells. So everywhere I looked, there were cancer cells. And they all looked bizarre and evil. And I knew immediately when I looked at that slide that this was horrible.
Yeah.
And it was difficult to then have to go back and relay that information to my father, who would know exactly what I was saying. So as I was describing that tumor to him, he got very quiet. He asked me a few questions, but I think he needed that information to understand what was happening because he was a scientist and he was a pathologist. You know, that's what my dad did. He sat behind a microscope, he looked at people's cancer slides and met with the doctor and said, here's what you've got. So I think he really needed that information for himself to then start to wrap his head around what was happening for him.
What do you want to say about the last part of his disease in his life?
He was really remarkable in that he had a lot of peace. He turned it over fairly quickly and kind of accepted what was going to happen. And in doing so, I think he had an inner peace about him at the end that was very helpful and comforting to us. It wasn't that he gave up by any means. He knew what was happening and he chose to say, okay, I want to spend my time with my family, but I know I don't have very much time.
Yeah. So since then, it's been almost 20 years now, 18 years, something like that.
18, yes.
You must have looked at a lot of slides of tumor cells and many, many other things. And I imagine that for a pathologist, normally you have a kind of distance between yourself and the sample that you're working with. I mean, you got a specimen under there. It's right in front of your face, but it's also a little removed. You're looking at it through a apparatus, and you may or may not know where it came from. Did that experience change your relationship to the kind of work that you're doing?
I think it did. Again, I don't diagnose patients. I do research. But having gone through this experience, it does help me understand it's not just the diagnosis and the patient. It's a person, and it's a person with a family and friends and a life. And the interesting thing is, at my position at the Hutch, I study lots of different kinds of cancer, but I haven't really had a big lung cancer study until just recently.
Oh, really?
And I think that was a very difficult study for me to do, because what I had to do is I had to review hundreds of cases of advanced lung cancer. And that's when it really hit me that sinister, awful-looking tumor was in other people. And I saw it a couple more times, looked very much like the tumor that I saw in my father. And that was very emotional and hard to do.
But you're on a mission now, right? And having encountered this stuff really early in your career in this personal way where you must have felt really powerless, does it feel empowering now to be kind of on the cure start here end of that?
It's really remarkable. So I get to see, in the case of the study with the lung cancer, was a new way to maybe diagnose and then lead to a targeted therapy for very aggressive late-stage lung cancer. So that's really cool.
This may sound corny, but I mean, do you ever think about what your dad would think of the work you're doing?
My dad became a physician, I think, because he really loved it. He was very good at diagnosing people. But I think if he had his choice, I think he would have done more the research side, which is what I do. I think he really liked being able to dissect and pull apart a problem, which I get to do a little bit more of that than he did. You know, when you diagnose, it's here's the information, here's the diagnosis. There's a lot of detective work and teasing things apart there, but you don't get to take it to the next step. You don't really get to dive in and say, well, what made it look like that? And I think he would have rather have done more what I did. But I do definitely think of him, you know, as I look through the microscope.
Well, Dr. Julie Randolph Habaker is a staff scientist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, where she's director of experimental histopathology, which basically means she's the high priestess of the microscopes. Is that right? Fair enough?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm going to change my letterhead now.
To high priestess.
Yes.
That'd be fine.
It was duchess, but now high priestess. I like that better.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. The theme of today's show is family business. Hollow Earth Radio started out as a labor of love. In two ways, really. It's a low-budget internet radio station that's definitely not making anybody rich. And it was founded by a couple, Amber Kai Morgan and her partner, Garrett Kelly. They started broadcasting out of their house 10 years ago. And now they're about to get themselves onto the actual airwaves. They're going to be a low-power FM station covering Seattle's Central District. For years, it was their family business. But recently, another family project began to affect their priorities. Producer Warren Langford has the story.
We met because my housemate was answering a Craigslist ad to play in a like an indie rock orchestra.
I played bass.
I played like accordion and like percussion things, like, you know, glockenspiel and random things like that.
Oh, we played our cell phones too.
Oh, yeah.
We would call each other on our phones.
Flip phones. We had flip phones.
And then
put it on speakerphone and let them like feed back and like move them close and far away, and they would make all this weird feedback. Right after we recorded that, your sister told you, "Hey, Amber, I had this weird dream that I was making out with Kurt Cobain," and he pulled away, like, real passionately, and he said, "Tell your sister not to use the phones." But we used the phones anyways. We totally didn't take Kurt's advice.
And I think what was happening at the time is that we were seeing a lot of really great music around town happening. But the venues that we were going to were houses where they were hosting really small living room shows. All these houses were getting shut down. Nothing felt sustainable. And we were like, well, what if we found a way to support this music network? So we started to like try to hold meetings, but hardly anyone would show up.
Like, first time like Joseph showed up.
Yeah, one friend showed up and felt like maybe, well, why don't we just get it all set up and do it ourselves? And then people were like, oh, you're doing neat things. Oh, I heard this house show on the radio. And we found a house that we could use the whole attic that was a finished attic. Had like 13 people who committed to being DJs, trained them how to use the like cobbled together equipment that we had.
Some of my favorite things to hear at first was like when a DJ would forget to turn the mic off and they would just have conversations over the music. Oh man, it was so good. That was like the glory days. There's this one time at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning when a DJ invited a funk band to start playing. At the time, 10 o'clock was, you know, way early for me. So having trumpets blare in the attic was a little much. And then I think, you know, also I'd just be like eating cereal, my boxers in the living room, and some DJ would walk through and I'm like, wow, jeez, you know, like this is getting to be like there's no privacy, there's no separation.
Garrett would get a technical support call every time we were on a date. So I started recording those calls because it was driving me crazy.
The effects window, just click any one of the empty squares. I think right click. Do you see one for application mixer? Sure.
Our friend Alex owns this bike shop called 2020 Cycle in the Central District, and we were hanging out with him and complaining about all the DJs and... Then he's like, there's this room next to my bike shop where I just throw my bikes, and I could still put my bikes in there, but you guys could do the radio show. And then once we saw it, we're like, yeah, you're not going to put your bikes in here anymore. This is our spot now. There was some criticism of us moving into the neighborhood. That turned into a conversation that eventually led to this show called Central Sounds.
So, now it's time for Central Sounds. And
from the people who were actually criticizing us, exploring the music legacy in the neighborhood and kind of current stuff that was happening, changes in the neighborhood.
I mean, one thing about this neighborhood, because it is changing, and we said that we were going to talk about Hollow Earth Radio being here. Even Hollow Earth is almost like a little gentrifier of the neighborhood. I mean, let's just be completely honest.
That made me realize that, oh, this can be something that's really can actually serve a higher purpose. There's a guy named P. Supremo who was kind of been in the penitentiary system his whole life, and he did a show called Welcome to the Yard about like the systems that he's been kind of stuck in.
Man, this is P. Supremo. This is Welcome to the Yard. This is prison talk and hip hop, man. You understand what I'm saying? We talk that real up here. We're gonna give you the real prison every time we do it. According to a recent study, and ladies,
he actually called in one time and did his show over a payphone because he was, I think it was like a halfway house or something of that kind of thing. You know, he's in custody.
I'm actually in jail right now as we speak, and that's just how real the show is. They restricted my movement. We were doing the shows, things were going good. Next thing you know, I'm being pulled over, and now I'm trying to get out.
I actually kind of stepped down from running the radio because I felt I wanted us to have a baby, and I was feeling like maxed out. And So I've been involved minimally.
What did you do to kind of fill Amber's void?
I panicked. I was mostly the person doing all the tech stuff and then coming up with weird ideas. And now all of a sudden I'm dealing with the nonprofit status things and volunteers. And so it's kind of a big change.
It's hard because he gets upset, I think.
Yeah.
What?
You know, there's just sometimes when, like,
say it.
You know, I'm like complaining about something, or I'm like going through some tough thing, and then you're telling me like, "Oh, you should do it this way. Why didn't you just do it that way?" And yeah, I'm like,
"I'm good at that."
Yeah, you're real good at that. But it's like, man, I wish you would just be here with it.
Now we're not doing the band, and we're not doing the radio together, but we have this kid together now.
We would have known that we were going to create this project that was 24 hours a day, every day. Like, what the heck were we thinking, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it totally is all-consuming.
Yeah.
Once you guys are on the air, how do you think Hollow Earth is going to change?
I'm hoping more people can discover it just by, like, driving around and tuning in and being like, what the heck is this? Like, actually, our call letters are K-Huh, you know, kind of like,
huh?
Yeah, huh? Or huh? You know, lots of different ways you can do the huh, I think. But I kind of want people to be able to tune and be like, what is this? Early on, when we first started the radio station, I had this dream that it's way in the future, and like the big corporations, they've all abandoned radio. No one wants those analog frequencies anymore. Everything's the internet now. And they're just kind of laying empty. So people have figured out how to do these little micro broadcasts from their house. And there's like this little underground culture of people driving around and like tuning in. And like, this block, there's this really cool radio station this person does. And they drive around to another block and, you know, and they write down and they trade them like trading cards, like all these little micro stations. And I think like that's what I hope. It's like people can like drive around their neighborhoods and like pick up on these like neighborhood sounds, like the little flavors of all over the city.
That story was produced by Warren Langford. Hollow Earth Radio is right now having its annual month-long experimental and underground music extravaganza called Magma Fest. You can find out how to listen and learn more about the station at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we are telling stories of family business. And we're going to close our show with two stories of fathers and sons drifting apart and then coming back together in pretty unlikely ways. First, we revisit my conversation with Logan Hofkamp, who, as a teenager, had a thought that almost every young person must have at some point. It goes like this: I think I'll be better off on my own and out of this crazy family. Well, it turns out you can actually do this. You can become essentially a legal adult before you're 18. It's not easy, and not that many people actually follow through on it, but Hofkamp did. He grew up near Bellingham. He lives in Santa Monica, California now, and he says he's a little older and a little wiser.
I'm 23 years old.
And how old were you when you became emancipated?
I believe I just turned 16, maybe a few months into being 16.
So for starters, maybe you can just explain, what is emancipation and what does it entitle you to?
So becoming an emancipated minor is basically divorcing your parents and becoming your own legal guardian, whereas you basically have the power of attorney and you are basically a legal adult in terms of being able to sign documents and govern yourself. You obviously can't buy alcohol or vote or anything like that.
So what was going on in your life at that time that got you interested in this?
Well, my mom had moved away to another state, so she wasn't around a ton. And I was living with my brother and my father's house. things were a little rocky. I was kind of a rebellious teenager. I was doing things that he wasn't super excited about, obviously. And we were butting heads. We were kind of getting in fights, getting in arguments. I decided to just kind of take off and do my own thing. And then, I mean, it just kind of escalated to that point. I wasn't really aware of it until one day my boss kind of had mentioned that I can do this to work more hours.
So how did you do it? Like, what are the steps you have to go through?
I filed with the courthouse, and then I had to prove that I was had good grades in school, that I was in good standing at that point, that I was living on my own and able to support myself. They'll let you say goodbye as long as you can prove it on paper that you're all right, that you have your own mailing address, that you're not out doing drugs, that you're not out, you know, you're not out just basically causing trouble, as long as you're like a young, mature adult and you look like you've got a plan. You know, I would assume that my idea of going to school rather than working in, you know, like a retail store for the rest of my life was probably pretty beneficial to it.
To what extent were you really that person you were portraying yourself as, somebody who was really organized and had a plan and probably in a much better shape to parent yourself than your own biological parents were?
I would like to say that I was kind of able to, but nowhere near as well as my parents could have, to be completely honest. Obviously, I mean, there's so much wisdom in being quite a bit older than somebody, and it's just like you just don't have that wisdom when you're 16. I made it through it, and I made it through it pretty well, but I would say in all honesty, you're probably much better off having a parent figure. I definitely grew up way too fast, and I feel like I missed out on a lot of, like, you know, my high school experience, and even part of, like, you know, part of college. I missed out on a big part of college just working and, you know, any of that stuff where you just kind of lay around and do nothing with no worries. I feel like I missed a good 4 years of my life of not having to worry. I kind of cashed that in to be on my own.
How did your dad take all of this? Even though you had something of a rocky relationship, was he okay with it when you told him that you wanted to declare emancipation?
He certainly fought me on it, and he did not think it was a good idea. And obviously it reflects, I mean, from the outside, I mean, if you just out of context thought, you know, somebody divorced their parents, it sounds very, very bad. And it, you know, probably doesn't reflect the best. But, you know, after a bit of talking, a bit of fighting and going back and forth, I think it eventually became kind of a mutual benefit to both of us. You know, to be quite honest, I kind of feel bad about it now.
You feel bad about it because you feel like it hurt his feelings?
Yeah, I definitely feel like it hurt his feelings. And I mean, how could it not hurt somebody's feelings?
So can you see it more from his point of view now than you could then? And if so, what's different?
I would say every day I get older, I see it more and more from his point of view. I mean, I'm certainly glad I did it, and I think he's certainly glad I did it in the long run. But, you know, I had one side of my parents, my mother, who was kind of like basically telling me I could, you know, do what I want and things like this. And then I had my dad, who's a very kind of like strict, straight, stand-up kind of guy. And, you know, I feel like I should have listened to him a lot more instead of my mother. And we just kind of started mending fences. The more I saw how often, you know, his idea was right, or it was kind of the right way to do things was his way, I think I kind of became closer to him. And now I really look up to him.
Did you have some kind of a ID that showed that you were emancipated, that you were no ordinary teenager? Oh no, you were a miniature adult?
I didn't exactly have an ID. I mean, I had a paper form, and I guess I could show it to somebody, and I have shown it to some of the girls that I had dated at the time, and I don't know, maybe that helped, but it's certainly an awkward thing because it's the law, and that's not really clear either, if you can, you know, date somebody who's over 20 if you're under 17 and emancipated. It was just kind of an awkward thing. I mean, I had to explain to a lady that, you know, she wasn't going to go to jail if she slept with me, only if somebody decided to press charges, and that somebody would have to be me. Very weird, weird thing. I don't think she was super into it, if that makes sense.
That kind of delights me for some reason. I don't know. I just love the idea of you making a sort of complex legal argument about why it's okay for you guys to sleep together.
Yeah, exactly. Why statutory rape's okay because of this piece of paper.
Well, Logan Hofkamp grew up outside Bellingham, Washington. He became an emancipated youth at the age of 16. And now about 7 years later, he's down in Southern California doing kind of a crazy job. He rents out Lamborghinis and brokers chartered yachts and things like that. So he seems to have done okay for himself. Logan, thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you, Gabriel. Really appreciate it. And it's a pleasure talking to you.
This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we are closing out our show on family business. And we do that with our second story of an estranged father and son finding some common ground. So this one starts a few decades back in the era when hippie culture was catching fire across the country. But it was early enough that in places like rural eastern Washington, this was still pretty foreign. That is where my KPLU colleague Nick Morrison grew up and would eventually return to. We've heard some stories of Nick's past lives here on these airwaves. These include his stint as the manager of a downtown burlesque club.
The way that I determined to solve that problem was to start a daycare in a striptease theater.
And as an indie rock financier,
I threw the 10 $100 bills on the table and said, let's rock. I probably didn't say let's rock, but I wish I would have.
So with a resume as varied as Nick's, maybe it's no surprise that at some point he did get involved in the family business, which was not something Nick was expecting.
My father really struck it big in business after I had grown up and left the house. He got into a three-man corporation that grew potatoes and then were their own middleman. He's raised and shipped tubers to the far corners of the earth.
So you're a young adult at this time. What era are we talking about here? What years?
This would be 1967, 1968. I came back to Eastern Washington from the Bay Area to see my mother, who had had a small heart attack. So I hitchhiked into Othello from San Francisco, went to my parents' house, put my duffel bag down, and began to walk across town to the hospital to visit my mother. And I had a ponytail, and I had bell bottoms, and I had a velour pullover. And people were pulling over, literally, to the side of the road as I walked down Main Street to look at me. They had seen these pictures in Life magazine, but they hadn't seen them in life. So I'm back in Eastern Washington. I'm going to move to Seattle, but I have no money. And though my father and I never really knew each other throughout my entire childhood, he felt it incumbent upon him to give me a job.
What was your dad like? What kind of a guy was he?
My father was a very upright fella. He was very well respected. He was a very honest man. He was a decorated Marine from World War II, very proud of his service, but not the great Santinian anyway. But as I said, we didn't really know each other. We were two different guys in two different worlds.
And did he have any preconceived ideas about the kind of culture that you were into, about hippies and long hairs and stuff?
It mildly disgusted him. You know, when I showed up and we met eye to eye, you know, I think he probably said, Jesus.
Did you get the sense that he respected you?
Not at that time, But my job in the family business was to stand around with a hand truck, right? And there was a machine that would take potatoes, drop them into 10-pound bags, cinch the bags, drop them on a conveyor belt. They'd go to the end of the conveyor belt, and people would put 5 10-pound bags into a box, seal the box, put the box on the hand truck, and do that 5 times until your hand truck was full, and then you'd push it out to a box car or a semi-truck. So I spent all day looking at this machinery working. And one day it dawned on me that if they rejiggered it just a little bit, there was a good possibility that more potatoes would come out faster with fewer people.
What was your motivation in making this improvement? Was it because you deeply cared about the efficiency of the business?
No, there were some guys who had been around the warehouse business longer, and they got to just count things as they went by, not push them.
And so they're using their eyes rather than their shoulders.
Yeah. So I went to my dad and I said, hey, I've got this idea. If I can make this machine more efficient with fewer people, can I have a counting job? And he said, you'll have to talk to Jacobson. He's your foreman. So I went to Jacobson. Jacobson thought he'd give it a try, and it worked. And a light went on in my dad's head. I didn't realize that the light had come on for maybe about a week. And then all of a sudden, there's this other long-haired guy popped up out of nowhere. He's working there, and he, too, stands out because of his appearance. So we gravitated toward each other on a break, and he said, you're the boss's kid? I said, yeah, for all the good it does me. And he said, that guy scared the hell out of me this morning. He said, I was coming through town looking for work. I stopped on that side street by the tavern, went in the tavern, asked around, didn't get very much information, got drunk, went back out, and slept in my car, which is where I sleep most nights. And he said, this morning, I woke up and somebody was pounding on my window. And it was this guy who I thought was going to want to beat me. So I just rolled my window down a crack. It was your old man. And he said, hey, you want a job? What happened was he saw me, kind of the worthless son, get an idea that helped his business. And he thought, there are lots of people floating around this country just like my boy, and they're not getting put to work because people don't like the way they look. I'm going to start hiring them. And this could work out well. So by the end of the season, he had a lot of hippies, including a Rhodes Scholar. People were always coming through town looking for harvest work. And he just started picking off the long hairs.
Did you know that he was capable of making that kind of a shift?
I did not. And it was the beginning of a long and lovely friendship.
Really?
Yes.
So, come on. You're telling me that this actually opened up the father-son relationship too?
It was definitely the door.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I never took the time to get to know the guy, right? Until he started hiring people that looked like me, and then I thought he might be okay.
Maybe this guy's all right.
Yeah.
He had the same thought about you, I guess.
I think he did, yeah.
Did this kind of open-mindedness or openness to people that didn't look like the people he was used to being around, did that persist, do you think, or was that a passing thing?
No, it persisted and succeeded wildly. The next couple of years was kind of a downturn in the potato biz, and my father and his little corporation, the family business, kept having successful year after year after year.
And the secret?
Hippies.
Nick Morrison is our production manager and spud wrangler here at KPLU. Thank you, Nick, for sharing your tale of joining the family business.
Well, thank you for asking.
That's it for the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson, with help this week from Warren Langford, Nick Morrison, and Matthew Stribe. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Our podcast is available in lots of places, including iTunes. You can subscribe and, while you're there, rate and review the show. Those reviews really help us reach more people, as well as making Allie and Kevin and me feel good. You can also send your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org. Find our page on Facebook and tweet at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. One more thing, if you like living in a world where KPLU exists, you might think about donating to help save the station. Find out how at kplu.org. We'll meet you back here next week when we'll be crossing the divide.
It was really simple. I mean, it was a church that opened a venue, did not preach to you, and there are kids who obviously were in that crossover culture who weren't opposed to religion, who thought, maybe this is the kind of place that I could be involved in.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.